With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Public Utilities Commission mulls changes to net energy metering program. A proposed decision under consideration by the California Public Utilities Commission would bring changes to a program implemented to encourage private investment in on-site renewable energy. The state's Net Energy Metering Aggregation Program, also known as NEMA, has led to increased adoption of solar and other renewables by farms, ranches, and other businesses. The PUC on November 2nd is due to consider the changes that would effectively eliminate the benefit of aggregation for power used and generated by customers with more than one utility meter. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Changes to paid sick leave. Beginning January of 2024, California state employers must offer paid sick leave for 5 days or 40 hours. AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keene shares just how this updated rule may impact employers.
Having kind of some uncertainty. So if you are in the heart of production and you have employees that end up calling in sick and you don't have the team that you have in place to, finish up your harvest. So there are going to be some gaps that employers are going to end up feeling impacted by. And it's one of the things that we're going to encourage our ag employers to think about. We are also very cautious about our ag employers making sure that they are not telling employees that they can't take their paid sick leave. We want to make sure that they make those days available. This is an issue that the labor commissioner has been paying a lot of attention to. And as employers, we're not allowed to, deny them their sick time. We can put together some policies, but we can't and ask folks to give us advance notice if it's a doctor's appointment. But in the case of maybe you wake up in the morning and you're not feeling well, call your employer as soon as you can. But on the employer side, there's not a ton that you can do about it. And at the end of the day, it's going to be in terms of mitigating your risk. You want to make sure your employees are getting those sick days. It's going to be a lot cheaper than having to go through a, citation, a penalty, or litigation.
We'll hear more from Keene later in today's show, but right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
Energy rate increases have been delayed, but are still on the way. President and CEO of the California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association, Roger Isom, explained the types of rate increases that ag operations can expect to receive.
The increases are still on the way. They delayed, PG&E did their 23% increase that would have been effective in September until looks like at least December, probably into January, which is good for our members, both gins and haulers. We're going to, hopefully wrap up before Christmas or first of the year. There'll be some that will carry over, but at least the bulk will get under the current rates. But no, there's rate increases coming. We're still fighting additional rate increases on top of that. $3 million a mile to underground electric lines that PG&E is spending. And, they've got 10 to 11,000 miles of line to do. Same thing, right? Everybody's issue. It's wildfire, but the ratepayers are paying it.
Efforts are underway to better understand a new beetle that has the potential to have a significant impact on tree nut crops. Manager of the California Pistachio Research Board, Bob Klein, explained some of the early mitigation approaches for the pest at the recent CAPCA conference as researchers continue to work to learn more about it.
Well, the first thing is because it over, at least in the countries where it already occurs, similar beetle damage, the beetles overwinter in mummy nuts in the field, much like navel orangeworm. And so winter sanitation is going to be the first step. Right off the bat, we don't have any idea about when the beetles might emerge in the spring. We can't time sprays, even if we knew what pesticides work, because we don't know when the appropriate times are. The sprays that are being used to control navel orangeworm egg laying on nuts in the field in the late season as the hulls degrade will probably work pretty well. But not chemicals like methoxyfenazide, which are growth regulators for Lepidoptera, and this is the Coleoptera. Anybody who thinks they've seen it in their field should contact Houston Wilson. He's the associate IPM specialist located at the Kearney Ag Center and is leading the efforts on it.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Senators Martin Heinrich of New Mexico and John Hoeven of North Dakota announced this week that the Senate has passed a bipartisan resolution they introduced to designate November 4th as National Bison Day. Jim Matheson is the executive director of the National Bison Association.
We've been celebrating National Bison Day for about over a decade now, and it's just a day for us to celebrate the bison, which is our national mammal of the United States. We had that established in 2016 for bison as a national mammal through the National Bison Legacy Act. And along with that, we've been celebrating National Bison Day, like I said, every year since then. And it's just a chance for folks to celebrate bison in all its forms. So we're talking about farms and ranches, of course, that raise bison for this incredible meat and byproducts that we raise, as well as conservation folks that are raising this animal in parks and public places, and tribal groups that are raising bison on their tribal grounds across the country.
Like many segments of agriculture, Matheson says the bison industry would like to see Congress pass a new farm bill.
So we were in D.C. in September lobbying for the farm bill, for the bison industry's priorities there. And really, you know, any type of conservation program tends to help us just in the way that we manage this animal. Bison were never domesticated, so it does take a bit of a different set of management skills to handle this animal, and it works very well with the conservation programs through outfits like NRCS, et cetera. So we've been lobbying for increases in those programs, but more so, you know, we're still fighting for inclusion, just for general relief programs that benefit farmers and ranchers that have excluded bison in the past. It's gone a lot better over the past 10 years, but we're always lobbying for inclusion of bison specifically in the farm bill language so we can ensure that our bison producers there are getting covered just like their neighbors are. Otherwise we, you know, are very supportive of the rest of the programs and the other titles there, that again, support conservation and what we do as bison ranchers.
According to USDA's latest agricultural census, South Dakota and North Dakota lead the nation in bison production.
New Mexico is up there as well. But the bottom line is we've got bison in just about every state these days, on farms and ranches, raising, again, this animal for its meat and byproducts. So you can find bison across the country anymore, but a bulk of the production does happen in your neck of the woods there in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, the Upper Plains states.
You can find out more information about how to celebrate National Bison Day at bisoncentral.com.
And on there, you can learn all about raising this animal on a farm or ranch. You can learn about its history. You can learn how to cook it, where to find the meat, and also tons of information on the many attributes of bison, particularly the nutritional benefits of bison meat.
In other ag news, in the third quarter of 2023, the corn sector wrapped up the 2022-2023 marketing year and entered the 2023-2024 marketing year. Geopolitical tensions and international dynamics continue to be factors in the market. Looking ahead, a National Corn Growers Association webinar says the war in Israel could have larger implications for corn if it spreads throughout the Middle East. On the macroeconomic side, interest rates continue to rise while the economy remains strong. That might make it a challenge to forecast an economic landing, especially considering geopolitical factors. Despite widespread drought across the Corn Belt during the growing season, the U.S. is positioned to produce one of the three largest corn crops on record. That positions the U.S. to have enough grain needed to fill demand. Even with the strong competition in the world market, the outlook for demand from ethanol, feed, and exports is more positive than it was a year ago. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association recently took part in an event where a variety of international agricultural issues were discussed. Will Jordan has more details.
The International Meat Secretariat held their World Meat Congress recently in Maastricht, Netherlands. NCBA's Executive Director of Government Affairs, Kent Backus, shares more.
World Meat Congress is essentially, we kind of dub it sometimes as the United Nations of meat. It is a gathering of meat industry representatives from all over the world. So beef, pork, lamb. For us, NCBA has been involved in the World Meat Congress for the last couple that they've had. Previous one was in Dallas, and the one before that was in China. And so World Meat Congress is a gathering of the International Meat Secretariat, which is a nonprofit organization that consists of all of these trade groups. NCBA has been part of that for the better part of the last decade. That is it's an association that is recognized by many of the international bodies, including the World Trade Organization, the World Organization for Animal Health, the Codex Alimentarius, and several others. So that means that they have standing and that they can actually engage in a lot of those meetings. So it does give us an opportunity to participate from time to time to really advocate for science-based standards and to really try to build our network of contacts so that we can coordinate and work together with like-minded producers around the world.
For more information, visit southeastagnet.com. For the Southeast Agnet, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And the October Dairy Market Report is out. And according to the report, reduced milk production and strong domestic consumption are showing up in dairy product production and inventory levels, thus offsetting weaker exports and setting the stage for the milk price rebound long foreseen in dairy futures markets and beginning to show up in dairy statistics. According to the report, U.S. consumers continue their strong uptake of dairy products during the summer as domestic use of milk in all products rose by 3.3% in the June through August period. Weakness in world dairy demand, meanwhile, has dropped the share of its milk solids production in the U.S. exported this year by about a full percentage point below the record levels of the previous 2 years. The report notes that milk production was down year over year during the June through August period. Industry experienced its second year in a row with an episode of annually lower output. Milk solids production growth continues to outpace milk production growth by nearly a full percentage point as higher butter prices this year strongly encourage dairy farmers to continue boosting their butter fat and protein test levels. The August dairy margin coverage, or DMC, rose by $2.94 per hundredweight from July to reach $6.46. This is the second highest margin after the one set back in January of this year, as the milk price was the main driver of this change. And on the dairy trade front, the report notes double-digit percentage drops from a year ago are still being posted for most U.S. dairy product exports. To see the numbers from the October Dairy Report, just go to the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The latest trends in agricultural land ownership. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The landscape of land ownership has evolved over the past 25 years as a generational transfer of ownership takes place. A Farmers National Company report says a strong ag economy has driven the market higher for several years. Most landowners have seen steady increases in value during the past 25 years, but especially within the past 3 years. FNC says one market dynamic farmers can always count on is change. Politics, world events, and other factors will continue driving change in the agriculture economy and land values over the next 25 years. Generational transfer of land ownership will continue bringing changes to who owns the land, One constant in the market is the fact that they are not making more land available. FNC says the U.S. loses an average of 1.8 million acres of farmland every year, which will only add to the limited supply available and more change in the marketplace. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. If you're thinking about selling grain or livestock this fall and deferring payment, make sure you do it right to get the tax deferral that you want. There are rules that must be followed. To defer income from the sale of grain or livestock, a deferred payment contract must be structured properly to prevent an IRS claim that you constructively received the income, even though you didn't actually receive it in the year of sale. There are three key points. Don't have the sale income credited to your account. Make sure the buyer doesn't set it apart for you. And make sure that you can't access the funds. A properly drafted deferred payment contract can satisfy these requirements. Under this type of deferral contract, the price of the goods is set at the specified time for delivery, but payment is deferred until the next year. Also, make sure you don't have any right to demand payment until the following year. The contract, as well as the sale proceeds, must also be non-assignable, non-transferable, and non-negotiable. If structured in this manner, the deferral should not be challenged by the IRS. If it turns out you don't want or need to defer, just report the income in the year of sale. But remember next year that you did that so that you don't report the income twice. Also remember that you're unsecured until you get paid. That's a problem if the buyer files bankruptcy between the times for delivery and payment. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Yes, this song was the big hit when I first came to the Agriculture Department. The year was 1974. And even back then, people were already worried because the average age of U.S. farmers was about 55 years old, and there didn't seem to be many young people willing or able to get into farming. And as the years have gone by,
it has been a national concern, and it doesn't appear to be abating.
That's Glenn Smith. He's an Iowa farmer, also a member of the board of the Farm Credit Administration, which oversees the lending associations that make up the Farm Credit System, the single largest provider of financing to American agriculture. Glenn says for the last few years, the Farm Credit Administration and the ag lenders it regulates have been wrestling with this question.
What can we do to help and assist young beginning and small farmers?
Smith says the answer to that question is in some upcoming new rules for lender associations. Generally, the rules require lenders to improve their current young beginning and small farmer lending programs, so-called YBS programs, and to actively reach out to a more diverse group of potential borrowers. Now, of course,
obviously, it's more efficient to go out and lend to a large, established, mega-million-dollar operation as opposed to a dozen small loans, but in order to ensure the prosperity and the growth of future generations, we must have that outreach.
Because these young farmers or farmer wannabes need all the help they can get just managing costs and paying the bills. For example,
just in the last year, we've had an increase more than double of interest rates. Our fuel expenses, our fertilizer expenses, but our land and machinery expenses are just tremendously high. And I don't think we'll be going down anytime soon. Usually those things don't go down. So their young beginning small farmers are facing some tremendous hurdles.
And Glenn Smith says, of course, this package of new rules is not going to remove those hurdles.
But it is a good step in the right direction.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Some scary news coming out of Wall Street on this Halloween. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Quarterly earnings season continues on Wall Street. Some major agricultural companies reporting this week. Wall Street ends a difficult month today. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ both falling into corrective territory last week. Meanwhile, the 10-year Treasury bond yield remains near historic highs, near 5%, and few notice the Treasury Department. Wall Street called it a financial bomb, reporting the U.S. deficit for fiscal year 2023 now $1.7 trillion. That's up 23% in just 1 year. And adding to the red flag on Wall Street, the Treasury Department used $879 billion just to pay the interest. This is the bottom line report. Among the companies reporting quarterly earnings today, Pfizer, Caterpillar, and AGCO Corporation. Eli Lilly reports this Thursday. And that's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
What will the winter hold weather-wise? Experts say we're heading into an El Nino for the first time in 5 years. Typically during an El Nino, we see a weakening of the northern jet stream, the polar jet stream, and a strengthening of the southern or subtropical jet stream. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has some predictions for temperature ranges for the country this winter as a result of the El Nino.
To the south, as you get into the area that's affected by the subtropical jet stream, we tend to see more rainfall and cloudiness. So temperatures may cue a little bit closer to what we would expect to be normal for this time a year, but that really just means it'll be cloudy and rainy and not particularly cold. And then with the hyperactive southern or subtropical jet stream enhanced by El Nino, oftentimes we see a very active storm track across the south.
He expects northern states to have a mild winter with temperatures higher than usual. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. Here is an awesome recipe for a pearl couscous pesto salad. Let's get untamed. Very simply, what we're going to do is we're going to make our couscous. All I'm going to do for this couscous is I'm going to take 2.5 cups of water. I'm going to add to that 1 whole cup of Israeli pearl couscous, and I'm going to add to that as well 2 tablespoons of butter, and we're just going to season our water to taste just so we have enough salt in there to help permeate the couscous and give it a good flavor. This usually cooks for about 5 to 6 minutes. Doesn't take very long at all to make your couscous go al dente. And once it comes to a hard boil, that's when you start that timer. So trust me on this one, it works great every single time. Now, making the pesto. Pesto is always tricky, but if you understand the basics of it, it is a very simple and incredible flavor to add to anything you're cooking. Now, all I'm going to add to this is 20 grams of basil, 52 grams of pine nuts, 70 grams of oil. You can use extra virgin olive oil. I prefer just using an olive oil blend only because the extra virgin olive oil is very, very strong. It's got a very strong bite to it, and you don't want that, especially if you're doing a really great pesto. You don't want to have extra on to that. And last but not least, we're going to do 1.5 ounces of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. This is the really, really good stuff right here. Minimum age 3 years, and that's going to give you some of the most incredible nuttiness and flavor that you need for a great pesto. All I'm going to do is pulse that until everything is combined. I am not going to turn this into a paste or into an oil. I just want to have it combined together. I want it to be chunky. That's good enough for me. I'm going to let my couscous, once it's done cooking, and I chill it down, just hitting it with some cold water and then putting it into a strainer and putting a couple paper towels on that and put that into a bowl as well. And let that couscous cool down for at least a good 30 minutes to an hour. Then we're going to combine this with our pesto, and this is going to make for one of the most incredible pesto salads you've ever had, because that couscous adds so much flavor to this. Now, I've been asked before, chef, can we do this with tabbouleh and all these other different, you sure can, but for me personally, it's a texture thing, and I love being able to serve this kind of a dish with, you know, a beautiful piece of chicken or a nice fish. It goes so, so well. For this and many more of my Untamed tips, tricks, and all things, go to www.ajtheuntamedchef.com. As always, this is Albert J., the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
Coming up soon, a lot of people's favorite holiday.
Halloween, Halloween, ooh, Halloween. Ghostly things are gonna happen.
Maybe some amusing happenings, but maybe, yes, some truly scary things like food poisoning from foods that are not prepared and handled correctly at those Halloween parties.
I know we think of scary as like goblins and monsters and things, but foodborne illness is also pretty scary and not something to really try and invite to your Halloween gathering this year.
Or any year. That's Meredith Carruthers. She's a food safety expert with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. And yes, each year at this time, we get reports of people getting sick after having or going to Halloween parties, not from eating too much candy or anything, but rather from eating perishable foods that haven't been cooked properly or treated properly after cooking. Now, at almost every Halloween party, somebody dresses up like you-know-who.
Lord of corruption, master of the undead, Count Dracula.
Oh yeah, and we all know the mythical weapons to combat vampires. The crucifix, holy water, a good suntan. But Meredith says,
you don't really need those mythical things to keep foodborne illness away. It just takes some practice and some paying attention in your own home to make sure you're avoiding it as much as possible.
Your chief weapon against bacteria in the cooking process, the food thermometer. It works even on some creepy Halloween foods that Meredith likes to prepare for her unwary guests.
You know, one year I did spaghetti and meatballs, and we turned the meatballs into eyeballs, and so it looked really cool that way. It was almost like you're eating your face of spaghetti. But obviously we're cooking meatballs, so we needed to make sure that we were cooking them to a safe internal temperature as measured by that food thermometer.
And she says you cannot eyeball whether your eyeballs are cooked enough to kill any bacteria that might be in them. You need that thermometer.
So if you're using ground beef or ground pork or ground lamb, you'll want them to be cooked to 160 degrees. If you're doing ground turkey or ground chicken, they need to be 165 degrees.
Or any kind of poultry needs to get up to 165. Now, if you're serving whole cuts of beef, pork, and lamb like steaks.
No, not the steak.
Sorry, Drac, not that kind of steak. Those cuts need to reach 145 degrees, and the same for fish. So cooking can kill any bacteria that was in or on the meat, but Meredith says there's bacteria everywhere in the air, on your hands, and everywhere. And when you put that food out at room temperature, bacteria can gather once again on those foods, and
bacteria will multiply to dangerous levels and scary levels if you leave those foods out for too long.
2 hours at room temperature, that's the limit. If you have questions about this or any food safety issue, you can call the Meat and Poultry Hotline, 888-MP-Hotline, 888-MP-Hotline.
And our food safety specialists are happy to help.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Have a safe, happy Halloween.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Water, a precious natural resource and essential for all farmers. But how much is too much or too little? And when is the best time to irrigate? Irrigation Water Management can answer those and other dilemmas by combining your knowledge of your farm with technical knowledge of plant, soil, and today's technology. At USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, we've seen farmers like you add 5, 10, 15% or more to your water savings using IWM. NRCS specialists can help you optimize water savings through management. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Neal. For today's interview segment, we have part three of my conversation with AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keen. We heard from her earlier in the show today talk about the changes to paid sick leave, and now she's got for us a couple reminders for employers as we inch closer to the new year. Now, Teresa, I know that these are two that sort of have some either new rules that need to be set in place or just some changes that we need to keep an eye out on. Now, we've already talked about a couple other changes that are happening also on January 1st of this year, or of, 2024. But I'd kind of like to just reiterate those and maybe give folks a reminder if they didn't necessarily hear it before. Now they can hear it now for the first time. But minimum wage is going up, and then there's some changes to overtime for small employers. Can we sort of go over those two topic points too?
That would be perfect. So yes, so I want to make sure, again, folks remember minimum wage is going up to $16 an hour. Also remember that we have overtime as well for ag employers or for ag workers. Overtime for ag workers for large companies, so 26 or more employees, is now at 40 hours a work week, so like most everybody else. But small employers, we're still ratcheting up or ratcheting down to that 40 hours. So overtime for ag workers for small employers is going to be 45 hours a week or 8.5 hours per day. So just want to make sure that people are paying attention to that. And in 2025, then everybody will be the same in the ag industry. It'll be 8 hours a day, a 40-hour work week.
Gotcha. That kind of simplifies things a little bit when everybody's sort of at the same playing field, if you will. Anything else you might want to add about those two before we move on?
No, I think we covered it. Okay. Just lots of change, lots of new things happening in 24, and we're not even there yet.
Right. So. I know. Well, actually, you know what, if folks want to, let's say they're confused a little bit, even though the jump in minimum wage has been happening for several years now, and so has sort of that overtime rule, right? But if folks, let's say maybe they're starting up a new business and they want to gather more information, can they go to you guys to seek that information?
Oh, absolutely. So call us, email us. We are happy to help walk you through it. We do math problems all the time as folks are walking through, their crazy work weeks when sometimes they end up having work stoppages because of rain. And so how does that factor in and making sure that they are abiding, they're staying within their allocated times and when to kick in, time and a half, or is it double time? So there are lots of factors and layers that go into this. It's incredibly complicated, and I am always impressed in how ag operations are able to figure it out with as many employees as we have in the industry.
Yeah. And this is sort of a question that I don't know if I've ever really thought of before, but and that may be because I haven't had to physically clock in quite some time. How do folks, how do employers keep track of when an employee clocks in and when they take a lunch and then when they clock out? I mean, with so many different changing parts and definitely more probably bodies on an operation during harvest time, that's probably got to be a bit confusing. So in your, over your time working with agricultural employers, what has been the best way that folks can keep track of all of this information?
Well, honestly, I have to say that implementing technology and having employers use the timekeeping records that some of our technology companies have developed is a fantastic way to make sure that we are being accurate and capturing the time that folks are working, making sure that, we're not doing one sheet for, your entire crew and having them all log, start work at 7 a.m. The labor commissioner is going to take a look at them like, no, there's no way that happened, because even though that's your intention, somebody ends up being late, or somebody ends up coming in early, or somebody ends up not coming in at all. And so making sure that you're accurately accounting for that time. And the other thing that we've been harping on is making sure that people are taking the breaks, taking their lunch periods. If something happens, the supervisor that's with that crew, making sure he or she is documenting it correctly, and then also talking to payroll, telling them what happened. This is why this, it could have been like we were almost done and, the crew decided, we wanted to keep working for a tick longer. So we ended up missing our initial, our initial lunch break. And so we ended up taking it a tick later. So just understanding those pieces and making sure you're communicating it with your team is so incredibly important, because that's where, when the breakdown in communication happens, that's when we have lots of problems in our industry.
So being transparent can go a long way with your employees, but then also with the folks who are maybe cracking down the whip, who could possibly be handing out those violations. When in doubt, just be transparent.
Absolutely, absolutely. And documentation of everything.
That's right.
You know, if somebody decides that they're going to skip their lunch period, making sure that you have your form and they're signing the form, understanding that, like, they're gonna waive their meal period. So just making sure that you're thinking through all those things. It's so hard because there are so many things that are happening and unfolding in the moment, and our supervisors are charged with managing it all. And so we understand, but you know, if something does happen, for them to be able to communicate it to employees and then also their teams.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. There are vacancies on the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Committee, CDFA, seeking to fill them. With a rise in regions under quarantine for citrus pest and disease, the California Department of Food and Agriculture is announcing two vacancies on the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Committee. This committee advises California Secretary Karen Ross on activities associated with pests that target citrus. Their duties also include outreach and educational programs and programs for surveying, detecting, analyzing, and treating those pests and disease that impact the industry. The committee is looking for two members, one member that represents Fresno County and another from Kern County. The Kern County term expires September 30th of 2027, while the term for the representative from Fresno County expires September 30th of 2028. If you're interested in participating with this committee, you can send a brief resume to the California Department of Food and Agriculture's Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division.
The 9th Annual Growing Together Latino Farmer Conference is taking place in Stockton tomorrow, and state conservationist for USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service in California, Carlos Suarez, highlights what the event is all about and what attendees can expect.
Our main focus is to bring those Latinos and Latinas, farmers and ranchers and forest stewards, to participate and learn more about NRCS, learn about other agencies like Farm Service Agency, Risk Management Agency, and Rural Development, as well as our state agencies like California Department of Food and Agriculture and the Resource Conservation Districts, on all the services that we can provide to Latinos and Latinas, and bringing it in their own language, in Spanish. We'll be translating in English for those that don't speak Spanish, but our main focus is so that these producers feel comfortable in their own language, listening to what the services and the tools that they have available in the state. We have assembled a group of farmers and ranchers who will be speaking on a panel about their operations, their challenges, but also the opportunities in getting conservation on the ground and how they have helped each other in doing that. So we look forward to have that panel that will include farmers and ranchers such as, you know, Maria Luis Reyes, and Florentino Collazo of La Milpa Organic Farms, and Berta Magana from Los Tres Compadres Farm, as well as we have visited in the past Javier Ledesma of Ledesma Farm. So we are looking forward to have those producers with others, agency officials, and technical experts in different areas like soil health, integrated pest management, how to work on a nutrient budget, and also on finance, agricultural finances, tools to run the finances on a farm, and how to maintain them and keep your operation sustainable.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Deere Foundation announces an anti-hunger grant. The John Deere Foundation announced a series of grants totaling $19 million aimed at eliminating hunger by increasing access to food, helping resource-constrained farmers, and supporting global food systems. The grant goes to the World Food Program USA, the One Acre Fund, and the Nurture Conservancy. Josh Jepson, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Deere, says, quote, "We firmly believe that the world's farmers deserve our collected support and advocacy if our goal is to realize the promise of the Green Revolution." The World Food Program receives $5 million to strengthen the capacity of the United Nations World Food Program, the world's largest humanitarian organization. One Acre Fund was awarded $7.5 million to accelerate its work to ensure every family farm has the knowledge and means to be successful. The Nature Conservancy received $6.5 million to promote natural climate solutions like forest restoration and conservation in key regions around the world. And AFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.